Welcome to Alaska's Native Voice. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous communities up and down Alaska's west coast continue to recover from a historic storm, which slammed into the state in September. The typhoon devastated Indigenous communities. People lost valuable resources, from boats to fishing nets, dry houses, and other tools essential to their Indigenous hunting and fishing subsistence way of life. People also lost food they had already stored up, essential to getting them through the winter. Join us as we talk about the typhoon, emergency preparedness, and the impacts of climate change, right after the news.
This is KMBA News, I'm Hannah Bissett. This week, the First Alaskans Institute held its 2022nd Elders and Youth Conference in person for the first time since 2019 due to COVID-19. KMBA's Antonia Gonzalez was there and has this report.
Took all their regalia.
Storyteller and cultural bearer Bob Sam from Sitka opened up the healing event by sharing some history of boarding schools in Southeast Alaska, from the early opening of the Sheldon Jackson School to students who were sent to the Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania. Sam says it was devastating for students to be stripped of their languages and cultures. He also shared some stories of boarding school survivors talking about the trauma they endured. Students were often told they were worthless, and many were physically, mentally, and sexually abused.
And when they arrived in Carlisle, it had to have been the worst experience of their life.
Sam, who works on repatriation efforts, has brought home the remains of many students. He says that work and his overall research of U.S. Indian boarding schools has caused him much trauma. He spent many years in Japan learning about Japanese culture. He then returned home to Alaska, embracing his Tlingit culture to help him heal from the trauma.
Primarily, I returned bodies and stuff like that, but I began to listen to the survivors and the people who suffered from the trauma of boarding schools, and from there I developed a ceremony.
Sam put on his traditional regalia, which he says is part of the healing process, describing each piece from his tunic to an orange apron representing Every Child Matters, a robe, and a woven headband representing Indigenous boarding school students in Canada. Sam then told a story about Raven and the return of traditional knowledge to the people. Sam ended the ceremony by having people form two lines. Boarding school survivors then walked down and were given affirmations, handshakes, and hugs from each person, as Sam sang. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The last day of Elders and Youth Conference was a joyous one. The sound of laughter, stomping, and clapping could be heard from the third floor to the first in the Domain Center. Compared to the last 3 days of the conference, Wednesday, the 19th of October, was shorter and had three major focuses: healing houses, resolutions, and music. Healing houses are used at Elders and Youth Conference every year, with a male, female, and the newest edition of an LGBTQ+ house, discussing various topics of how to grow, heal, and to connect with people in the community. Jeremy, or otherwise known as Jeremiah Miller, is from Nome and is a Inupiat. Miller joined the LGBTQ+ healing house. This year was Miller's first Elders and Youth Conference.
I think it's just hearing other people's experiences makes me think about my own experience more and what ways I relate to them. Like, I think I'll take back more of what people do to heal, or what they do to, like, be themselves more. Like, what helps them do that? Or trying to figure out how to word this. I think, honestly, just hearing other people's experiences makes me feel not alone, so I think I'll remember hearing those experiences, and I think to know that I'm not alone will help me heal.
After the healing houses concluded, the group gathered to hear about the resolution titled, Sobriety Programs Incorporated into Our Schools in Alaska. The goal is to help high school students who are exposed at an early age to drug abuse. A secondary goal is for the Alaska Board of Education to provide prevention education in schools in rural Alaska. Then the announcement for next year's language focus, Tlingit, was announced. Afterwards, a series of songs played with people wrapping around the entire main room on the third floor. After the conference, I sat down with Gloria Wolf, who was Tlingit and a staff member of First Alaskans.
Elders and youth is always a really magical time, but I feel like this being after the pandemic, people are showing up eager to be with each other.
For KMBA News, I'm Hannah Bissett.
The AFN Newscast is produced by KMBA and Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, supported with funding by Rasmussen Foundation, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, ExxonMobil Alaska, Chilista Corporation, Manilik Association, South Central Foundation, ConocoPhillips, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and Donlin Gold. This is a production of KMBA and Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, brought to you through Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Welcome to Alaska's Native Voice. From the floor of the 2022 Alaska Federation of Natives Convention, I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On the show today, we're talking about lessons learned after a powerful storm that started in Southeast Asia turned into a monstrous storm that slammed into Alaska's west coast in September. More than 40 Alaska Native communities were impacted. Some people lost homes. Many others lost tools they rely on to live a subsistence lifestyle. And a changing climate means these kinds of storms are likely to happen more often in coming years. Today, we're going to talk about how Alaska's emergency management can improve. Now, joining me now, I have three guests here. Chad Olson, he is the tribal administrator for Hooper Bay.
It's Jan, J-A-N.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
No problem.
And also Earl Samuelson, who works with the Bethel Search and Rescue in Western Alaska's Major Hub Community, and Millie Hawley is the tribal administrator in Kivalina, a village on the barrier island of the Chukchi Sea coast, 80 miles north of the Arctic Circle. And Millie, go ahead and start us off if you want to introduce yourself, please.
Good morning. Millie Hawley, Native Village of Kivalina. I've been the tribal administrator there since 2018, and before that, I was a tribal council president for at least 8 years. So I've worked with the tribe since 2001. And so the storm started 2000, or the erosion, the severe erosion started in 2004. So I had my work cut out for me.
And Earl, go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name is Earl Samuelson, born and raised in Bethel. Got into flying back in 1981, 79, right out of high school. Figured I'd get into aviation to get out of Bethel. Got married and moved 5 miles out of town. Still live in Neposkak. Flew airplanes commercially for a couple of years. And flew for the Alaska State Troopers for almost 35 years. Retired in 2014. Still involved with our local search groups. Which I think it brings me here.
Well, thank you for that. And go ahead, please introduce yourself.
My name is Jan Olson, tribal administrator for the Native Village of Hooper Bay. It's been a little over a year since I've been the tribal administrator. And before then, I was the city administrator. But now I'm the tribal administrator, and it's been a tough few weeks now.
Well, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about the community and what happened?
Well, yeah, as you all know, Hooper Bay, if you don't know it on the map, it's just right there, right on the west coast of Alaska, and we were just hit with all that wind and the waves. And, you know, our community has never seen anything like that within my lifetime. And a lot of our elders are talking the same thing. You know, they've never seen a storm that great.
And Millie, tell us a little bit about what happened to your community.
In our community, the erosion not only just hit the Chukchi side, but on our little island, we have on the lagoon side some homes lost ground. So without any help from any of the entities outside of Kivalina, our local search and rescue started removing some rock revetment, rocks or boulders from the Chukchi side to mitigate the erosion where the home was losing ground. So on the lagoon side, and they worked tirelessly for 2 or 3 days doing that. I got a whole, or one of the employees called from Tekalaska, and they asked, you know, if there's anything they can do. And I said, well, there's a home that's losing ground, so I know the local search and rescue is mitigating that. So next thing I know, a couple of days later, they were there helping the search and rescue, trying to keep that home from falling into the lagoon.
And Earl, can you talk a little bit about what search and rescue does and some of the work and why it's so important?
Okay, but first I'd like to say you.
Yep, go ahead.
Lepaskak and Bethel are 80 miles up to Kusakwim. And the very next day, we felt the water surge come up that far up. And normally we get high water in the springtime in our area during the breakup. But the surge was so strong that even high levels of water came up into Bethel and Lepaskak that I haven't seen in probably years. And we had homes that water got underneath them, but not like what Hooper Bay and the other coastal communities had. So that's how strong the storm was. Our group in Bethel, we're small. Even though we got some numbers, we're still a small group, and we're still learning. We'll try to help out any situation that arises. Like on this storm ones, our guys in Bethel were kind of monitoring water levels. We got a spot we call Alligator Acres. It's probably one of the lowest spots in Bethel. Some of those homes got water around them. I don't think water got in them. But like I heard, search and rescue groups, we're all volunteer and help out wherever we can. And each member or several members have different specialties, and try to, if they're good at this, let them do it. We're good at this, let them do it. I'm sure Hooper Bay is too. They know their area. We know our area. So we try to rely on your expertise. We don't want to see people missing. We want everybody come home alive if they can. I just read the story, that young man up there in Koyuk was trying to get to Nome. He didn't make it home. He should have made it home, I thought. Sometimes we can't. We do our best. Like now, last month we had a search out there since August 31 where a boat had flipped over. Two of the folks made it, got home late, but we're still missing for one more. Hopefully they find that person, but sometimes we can't. A little bit of elderly advice, though. I remember going out to communities. I like to have an elder guy. You know, I'm sure Hooper Bay has elder people that talk to us. And he told us, sometimes we can't bring everybody home. If a person falls in the water, the soil covers them up. The good Lord's taking care of them. And I see this many times in the wintertime. Someone perishes on the...
Go ahead, talk.
Or in the winter, the snow covers them up. The good Lord's taking care of them. And if you're on the tundra buries you. The good Lord is taking care of you. And that sticks with me all the time. And think about the people that we haven't taken care of or brought home. But the elder words, advice always come back. And remember what he says sometimes. And I get into arguments sometimes. Is the good Lord taking care of him? That's his way. Humanly, we want to bring them back, which is better. But May the good Lord watch over those.
And I definitely want to hear about elder advice from our other two guests, but something that I thought of when you were talking, Earl, is, you know, when we think of search and rescue, we think of people a lot of times, and now search and rescue is focusing on storm preparation. Can you comment on that?
For myself, we do, in our region at least, and I did pick up on the National Weather Service picking up when this big storm was coming in. They had a community-wide call in, trying to get that word out. Hey, this big storm is coming in, and try to prep for that storm. And in our community, I know if we're predicting higher water, as yes, we let folks know the forecast is coming, the water's coming, prep for that. If you ever had water in your community, you don't want water in your community again. I mean, if you've been evacuated, you don't want water in your community. But you can prep for that. And houses are up higher now. Like this last water surge, we didn't get the impact we did in like 2005 and then in 95. Homes are up higher. I want to say the community is getting everybody involved, even the school. If you do have to get your safe home or evacuated, and then my hat goes off to a lot of the school systems. I see they activated their plan to where folks can go to that school now. But also it'll get the word out to where bring your medications, your foods you like to eat with you, extra clothing, bedding, if you do have it ready to go, backpack it, suitcase it, or whatever, just in case. Because a lot of people didn't think it was going to happen, this surge, but it did happen. And I had to guess many people were not prepared to see what was ahead.
And I do want to ask, Millie, maybe you can go first, is looking and at the elders' advice that Earl was talking about, but also just is there any kind of talk about storms or anything getting worse or any kind of, you know, talk about that from the elders?
When we first had to evacuate in, I believe, 2009, I'm not sure about the years, but the first evacuation, more than 90% of the residents of Kivalin evacuated, barricading themselves across the channel with local ATVs to the port site. And then the local borough sent 9 charters out, and 90 people were flown to Kotzebue and housed in Kotzebue. And there were 2 elders. They refused to evacuate and they refused to get on the plane. And one of them was an elder in his early 70s. And he said, the storm will pass. It's not going to get worse. There's no reason to, you know, evacuate. He went out and looked, and you know, now the elders can look across the horizon and see a little black dot and say a storm is coming. Well, that's what this elder did. He knew it wasn't going to get any worse, so he stayed home. There were 52 people that year that stayed in Kivalina, and they were 2 children. Those 2 children were his grandchildren at school who were with 11 teachers. So we listened to our elders. Another elder recently, he went on the VHF. He's in his late 80s. He went on the VHF, and the first thing he said was, don't panic. Don't panic. Just prepare yourselves. Listen to the Weather Service. And so we have scouts during the night in the late evenings, we have people watching the waves, the weather patterns. And we have people using their apps nowadays. They use apps, and they follow the eye of the storm and see where that's going. So one of them is the city mayor, and he was following that. So he didn't see a need for, you know, evacuation at the time because they were following the storm. One elder we had was a teacher who's been there since 1978. He left Kivalina for health reasons about 3 years ago, and the community missed him dearly because he always knew, because he became a part of us, he always knew when things are going to get bad, and he's always, at one point he became the city mayor, and so he always, he used to always be able to help the community prepare. But our young folk with a lot of children, we all have VHFs at home, so the young folk, they learn to pack emergency bags in case they have to take off. And now we have an evacuation road up to the mainland, which is 8 miles in to a new school building. And they have that safety measure. Before that, they didn't. They couldn't even fend for themselves. I mean, if the water ever came over, there's no planes coming in. Coast Guard couldn't come in. Nobody could come in to save our people for anything. We're left all alone there. We have to fend for ourselves. And there was no way out of the island. But now people are a little bit more relaxed because now they have this evacuation road. And thanks to the state of Alaska, to the local borough, to tribal transportation program that all funded this. So listen to your elders. They know when you need to go, when you need to take off. They're the ones that will help guide the evacuation and stuff. So
thank you for that, Millie. And I definitely want to hear about Hooper Bay and advice from elders. And is there any talk about, are storms going to get worse, or are they going to increase, or anything having to do with climate change as well?
Yes, just like Antonia?
Millie. This is Millie.
Oh,
yep.
Sorry. Nope. All right. Just like Millie said, you know, we've always heard stories, you know, from our elders. And with my grandma, she'd always tell us that, you know, our weather is going to change. And she was in her just about 100 years old in 1988. She passed away, and you know, I always hear stories from her saying that our weather is going to change, and it's going to change with the people. And you know, she even said that, you know, our weather will mumiktak. That means change with the lower 48, and we could see it today. Look, back home where we got no snow, and on the East Coast in the United States, they're being bombarded with snow. And, you know, that was our weather. And, you know, she'd always tell us that someday we'd have to prepare to, you know, get away from our area. And, you know, there's even a shaman who told us that if the water reaches my grave, that's when Hooper Bay is going to be no longer there. And it's just right there now. It's just feet away. Back when I was a kid, we had about 5 rows of dunes on our beach. We're just down to our last row, and Old Hooper Bay is right there. There's no longer a place where in our beach where we could get fresh water, because all that salt water just went in and overflowed and, flooded, and there's no place for us to get fresh water on our beach. So we have to go further back. But, you know, we've heard stories as we were growing up, and I was naive in thinking that that will never happen in my lifetime, but I'm actually living it right there. And, you know, I'm afraid for my kids and my grandkids, because what are we going to do? But now we're, you know, before the storm hit, we were actually, you know, planning to move further inland, and now it's a must. It's not when. We have to do it now, because another big storm comes, it's just going to wipe away our last row of dunes, and, you know, the flood's just going to get bigger and bigger.
And Millie, go ahead, Earl.
Add on just a little bit on, like, one of our elders back home, my father-in-law, he'd look out the window and tell you what the weather was doing, and it was fairly accurate. But later on, it was changing, where he was predicting wouldn't happen. And he said, the weather is changing so fast, it's getting hard to predict. Just to throw that in there. And then the other thing that caught me was, if you watch the elements, the sun and how it goes down, I noticed he was watching that. And I started picking it up. Then all of a sudden, you know, I remember a couple of years ago, people were saying the world had shifted. And you don't see the sun coming up where it used to come up, or go down where it used to go down. So something has shifted, you know, and I noticed that, especially even this past summer, where the sun, where it was coming up, it's a little bit more, they say the sun comes up to the east, but it seemed to be more northeast to me this summer, if you notice it. Just to throw that out.
Well, thank you for that, Earl, and you're listening to Alaska's Native Voice. We are talking about the powerful storm that hit the state and looking at emergency response. We have three guests joining us today. It is the first day of the Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention. We have to take a quick short break, but we will be right back. Welcome back to Alaska's Native Voice from the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. We're on the floor at the 2022 Alaska Federation of Natives Annual Convention. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. I have three guests joining me today. We're talking about the powerful storm that hit the state and also looking at emergency management and response. We have Jan Olson, welcome back, Earl Samuelson, and Millie Hawley. Thank you all for being here today. And right before the break, you know, we were talking a little bit about advice from elders and looking at what they have to say about the storm and being prepared. And Millie, you talked a little bit about the technology and how that's changed, how people respond. Do you think that the use of both traditional knowledge and technology is helping in preparedness?
There's two different scenarios on that one. There's two different sides to it. The negative side is that people are watching it and getting more fearful on their apps, and but it's also on the flip side, it's also a good tool to use to prepare before the storm. And when they see the eye of the storm coming closer to Kivalina, the young folks, especially because they're really into their phones and their apps, they were more fearful and lose a lot of sleep. A lot of the young folks, especially those with babies, they lost a lot of sleep, and they were very tired at the end of the storm because they were watching their app, and that's a negative side. I mean, it's good to prepare. It's good to be prepared for that, but to stay up 24, 48 hours watching your phone and watching that storm, you know, it's not healthy. And that's why we have people scouting out, you know, through the search and rescue, the folks that volunteer to watch, you know, through the night what's going to happen. And it's helpful, both helpful and both fearful to have. So it depends on who, you know, who's doing the watching. You have to be very trustworthy in the community to be that person.
And Earl, anything to add to that about how the use of technology is it helpful? Is it hindering? Or anything to add to what Millie was saying?
I actually find it helpful, and as you can see, the storm's coming way in advance, and also note that their predictions, they're not accurate. As they get closer to you, then they get more accurate. But for distance forecasting, it's I can say it's helpful, but don't predict that that's going to be accurate. You can see big storms coming through Florida. They have models, and that's what the app is, modeling your predicting how these storms are going. And so far, they've been pretty accurate in our part of the state. So, yeah. And one thing we're trying to encourage is to get our young people more involved. As the old-timers are not going to be around for long. We're not going to be around for long. And we've got technology. It's these young guys that got the technology that can help out, like the underwater cameras, the underwater vehicles, the drone flying. I'm seeing these young guys that are playing the video games pick up these skills quicker than we do. And you know, we got to integrate these guys in here, get them in there, get them involved with your local search and rescue groups. And that's what I'm seeing. It's, there might be some hesitancy in there, but a good pat on the back. Come on, buddy. We could get you involved. I think it's probably the same all the way around everywhere. And I use my phone a lot, and I see my grandkids doing the same thing. And sometimes I'll throw out a question, and they can't answer it. They'll Google it.
And also thinking about the younger generations too, you know, being connected to technology all the time. But there's also drawbacks. What is internet broadband services like in Hooper Bay?
Well, it's we don't have the best internet. You know, there are some days that we are out of service for an hour or longer sometimes, you know, and it goes on and off, you know, and, you know, we're trying to get online, but there's no service. And, you know, it's not the best out there. And, you know, there are some times that we totally get cut off. If there's if the GCI is out, and, you know, there's no way to call Because nowadays, we're so dependent on cell phones. There's not very many landlines back home. And, you know, where our community, our tribal council is even talking about purchasing a couple satellite phones just in case, you know, anything happens. Because there are some times when, especially after storms, you know, there might be a line that got cut and you got no service from our local provider, the GCI company, and there's no way to call out or no way for anybody to call in. So, you know, where I brought it up with the council that we need an alternative way to reach out to the rest of the world. And, you know, satellite phones, it's nowadays it's a must to, in, you know, that's what our traditional council is thinking about. Because, you know, if anything happens and we're totally cut off, how are we going to reach out to the rest of the YK Delta, the rest of the world? And, you know, you mentioned VHFs, those could only reach so far, you know. So, you know, we're already thinking about the next step.
And then, oh, yep, go ahead, Earl.
Just to add on technology again, there's a, you mentioned satellite phones, but there's also the device called the InReach. It's satellite communication with texting. And they're always changing too, their models, and making it better and better and better. I've got one myself. I've got a couple more for our family members. I had gone away from the VHF and not really wanting to, but it's because of the cell phones that everybody is getting cell phones. And at least in our community, the VHF is phasing out, and it's the Facebook messaging. And that's useful too for flood preparation or disaster preparation, is people are leaning towards this. But if we don't have what, like you mentioned, what if everything goes down? And the InReach, we were doing a presentation one time, and we were passing around. Somebody pressed the SOS button. It wasn't even 2 minutes. The lady called up and said, "Earl, are you okay?" That's how fast technology works. And she was on the other side of the country. That's something maybe Hooper Bay or other villages can look into in a way of communicating.
And, you know, after the storm, then comes the assessments and the, you know, the public response and seeking assistance to help recover from the storm. Producer Emily Schwing was out there, and she got to talk to people about what they need next. Let's hear from Nick Tom, who is a leader in Newtok, and the village is currently in the midst of relocating 9 miles away to higher ground, and he has concerns about that, just about the federal and state assistance and how the government can help.
I think one of the biggest questions that we have is that if we apply for this disaster fund, would we still be eligible for, like, snow machine, outboard motors, housing, flood? We're not sure how that's going to be handled.
And that was a leader talking about looking at the state and federal assistance. Millie, your response to that, and how is your village recovering right now?
That's what I was thinking about this whole time. You know, we're left out there by ourselves to fend for ourselves, and there's no way not even the Coast Guard can come into Kivalina when we get into a storm. And our village, we have joined together both the city and the tribe, and we have developed some requirement documents, such as a FEMA hazardous mitigation plan, we got that together, and we've got the other skirt plans, and we put everything together for, you know, for the federal and state agencies to respond. And yet when it comes to a storm, nobody shows up. We're all fending for ourselves. We spend all this money to prepare with and communicate with the state and federal agencies. But in the end, we have only ourselves to take care of, and we have only ourselves to look to. After the storm, then we have all this red tape. You have to do this to get the reimbursement. You have to do that. Did you do this? Did you do that? Well, we were in a state of emergency. We didn't think about that at the time. So state and federal agencies' regulations and their requirements, they need to lax. They need to lax their requirements after the storm so that the people in the villages can recover and they can take care of, you know, if they can take care of themselves during the storm, then they can take care of themselves in recovery. They know what needs to be recovered. They know what needs to happen. And the state and federal agencies that have these requirements and the funding, then they need to be the ones to work with the communities, not against them, because they use that big word, that letter in the documents, regulations, to limit what is given to the community to help them recover. So I have a big problem with that.
And it's also holding accountable the agencies that are supposed to be helping the tribal communities. And on top of that, it's also good to have Native people in these positions because they know the communities and they know the assistance. Definitely want to hear from both of you, but just go ahead and respond with the federal assistance, and then we'll go to you, Earl.
Back home in Hooper Bay, you know, we didn't wait till, you know, we got a response from the FEMA or the state. You know, our traditional council, we went and already assessed on our own which homes needed this, which homes needed that, because a lot of damage was, you know, wind damage and roofing on homes. And, you know, a lot of calls were coming in saying, you know, we're starting to drip in our home. And, you know, we, as our traditional council went in, and we were lucky that there was a group from Wasilla who was actually there to do other work on one of our corporation's buildings. And we were lucky enough that they were there. You know, they were contracted, and they were able to go and assess the damage after. You know, we met with them. We actually sat down and we asked them,
you
know,
you
got your expertise. Can you please go and, you know, our Native corporation, along with our traditional council, asked them if, you know, they could go and assess, you know, before even the FEMA people came out. And, you know, we were lucky enough that they were able to go around and see and assess the damage. And they told us, okay, we want this much material for this many homes. You know, they, it was at least 20 homes that they wanted to go and, you know, fix up. It was the roofing. There was a lot of porches that, Arctic entries, but we call them porches, that just got blown away from that big old wind, you know, 80 knots, 80 mile an hour winds. And it's, they were actually there and they did their assessment, and they went out of their way. And our Native corporation allowed that to happen. You know, they said, okay, let's not worry about our building. I'd like for you all to go out and see what our community actually needs. You know, they went and assessed, and they came back and they said at least 20 homes worth. You know, we got all the material. We purchased all that material because, you know, right now it's our wet season. And, you know, it's something that we kept getting calls. My home is dripping. It's starting to drip, you know, because of all that, all the material, the roofing material that came off of our homes. So, you know, we went ahead and did that on our own. But, you know, we've had many visits from FEMA, Red Cross, and, you know, thankfully they were there. And, but it's, you know, something that we had to step over, and instead of waiting, we went ahead and did that on our own, because it's there's two homes that are totally destroyed, and there's three homes that were like not that bad damaged. One of them was mine. It was on a lower, it's on a lower part of the village. We have two town sites. It's an old town site, and there's a new housing site. And on the newer town site, there's how many subdivisions? There's the Tomahawk Hill, the main place. There's Blueberry Hill, Manning Hill. And when we flood, you know, we thought our road was high enough to where it's not going to separate our community. But when typhoon, we call it Mkhpak, that's really high water, Murpak. But when it happened, our community actually became not just two separate places, it became three. And, you know, we've never seen that water so high. You know, I'm 47 years old, and I've never seen that water come up to my home. I'm living in what my dad built, and, you know, the water got so high, and the waves, and the all that stuff that was coming up, it just moved it a few inches, but and my window got blew out, my porch got blown off, and it's we haven't been in there for a couple of weeks because we were kind of wary of going back to our home. But, you know, I reassessed it, and I'm like, I told my wife, it should be good to come back home, because we're actually in a evacuation center with two other families. And, you know, it's something that I never thought I'd see. And, you know, we're actually in talks with a native village of Baymid. They have tribal members that live in Hooper Bay. We've been talking even before the storm about relocating. And, you know, we knew it had to happen, but now we know it has to happen. Mm-hmm. It's not just when, it's gotta happen.
Thanks for sharing all of that. And it must be hard. I can't imagine, you know, being displaced for even a day, but go ahead, Earl.
Head on what Millie was saying is working with the FEMA and the state agencies, and I just reviewed the grant, 40,000 roughed it off, our funds available. If you take that 40,000 in the lower 48, you could probably do something. You take that 40,000 and put it up in Alaska, it's just a starting point. Snow machines now are $20,000, and I can see there's funds available per the grant application. $18,950. You could barely purchase a snow machine for that price, that one, if you lost a boat or a motor. I think we need to work with these lawmakers, increase those funds, and show that Alaska prices are way different from the lower 48. A house was $300,000 once to build, if you want to build a house in rural Alaska. And I'm kind of looking at the grant application, $39,000. You can maybe make your porch. See, there's a big gap. And same way, it's the same way in education. It's college education across America versus college education up in Alaska. We pay the highest prices on everything. And I think these grant application fees or what people can get are peanuts right now. And we need to work on the lawmakers to show that it's not enough to cover the losses. That should be $130,000 for cover your home damage. A snow machine, maybe that should be $50,000. It should be double up that. So
definitely. And there was also losses just beyond, you know, the houses. A lot of people lost their subsistence foods, their tools that you're talking about, the snow machines and other things. And then when the electricity went out, people lost, you know, all their freezer foods that are going to get them through the winter. So producer Emily Schwing did get to talk to somebody about that. Her name is Stella Lake, and she works for the tribe in Chivac, and she shared a little bit about that.
We were told to prepare, and we pulled up all our boats, anchored them down, but we didn't expect the winds to cause all that.
And it's not just boats, right? It's like, you know, fishing nets, all the sheds that are
yes.
lost. Tell me what was in the sheds.
Sheds were like nets, anchors, life jackets, gas tanks, all the necessities you need to go out by fishing boats.
Did you have a shed?
Mm-hmm.
Is it okay?
It's gone.
It's gone. Completely just gone.
Completely gone. My shed's been there since I was young. That was my dad's shed.
And it just is devastating to hear these stories. Millie, I know it's hard to think about all the losses, but you know, how do you recover from those types of losses?
A lot of our people have learned to mostly pray, you know, just for their sound mind to be able to move on, to move forward. But what do you do? What else can you do? You don't have a snow machine to go out hunting anymore. You don't have a boat or your fishing nets to subsist anymore. So what do? Do you just sit there and do nothing? Or do you, you know, the first thing I notice in my community is that they pray a lot. And that's where they find their strength to get up and start over and help each other. Like I said, we have a lot of young folks that are scouting through the night and taking care of other family members. If they're single, you know, they're taking care of each other. We listened to our elders, and when they said that we should share what we have, then we are open to that. Our young folk, I noticed they've been going out hunting, and they've been going in groups. They don't go by themselves anymore. They can't. They can't afford to because, you know, there's, like Earl said, you can't predict what's going to happen from one day to the next, from the morning to the evening. So I noticed that our young folk are starting to go out in groups, and they don't go by themselves anymore. So the only way we can recover is to band together, to take care of each other, to share what is salvageable, to share what is already, you know, what's there, and to pick each other up and to help each other to move forward. That's about the only thing we can do as a community. Otherwise, you just recede and you go back and you just perish. I mean, we don't want to see a community doing that. So we have to listen to our elders. That's what they taught the young folk to do. And you just pick yourselves up and be resilient as you are, because you're in a harsh element. You're in a place where you don't have anybody else to rely on but yourself. So.
Thank you for that, Millie. And we are running out of time. Thank you, Millie, Holly, the tribal administrator, and Kivalina for joining us today. Thank you for sharing your words. And Earl, go ahead.
I just want to add, and I'm very thankful, we had no loss of life out there. We were kind of worried about Hooper Bay, but that young boy showed up. And thankful for that. And a little bit of elder advice. It was... You probably hear this. You can lose stuff. You can rebuild stuff. But if you lose a life, you cannot rebuild that life. Be thankful for all the things you have and got. But someday, like, we might not have that anymore. So be thankful. Thank the good Lord you're here to express that. Thank you.
Thank you, Earl Samuelson, who works with the Bethel Search and Rescue in Western Alaska. Thank you for joining us today. And we have just less than a minute, so go ahead, Jen.
You know, it takes a community, but it also takes a whole state. We're all Alaskans. You know, we're totally from different areas. You know, I'm from the coast, you're from up north coast, and you're from the Kuskokwim. But, you know, we all have unique challenges, and but we're all in it together. You know, that's one thing that, you know, I love about Alaska.
Definitely.
We have to stick together.
Thank you so much. We're out of time. You've been listening to Alaska's Native Voice. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Join us again tomorrow.
AFN, Alaska's Native Voice. Produced and directed by Antonia Gonzalez and Emily Schwing. Broadcast support provided by Rasmussen Foundation, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, ExxonMobil Alaska, Calista Corporation, Manilik Association, South Central Foundation, ConocoPhillips, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and Donlin Gold. This is a production of KMBA and Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, brought to you through Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.